This is Gulf Coast Life. I'm Mike Canivery. Thanks for joining us. Ron Shapiro started off as a civil rights attorney in the late 1960s after graduating from Harvard Law School, and then he founded his own law firm in 1972. But then a series of events led him to becoming a player agent in the world of Major League Baseball, and he went on to become one of the most respected agents in professional sports history. He's retired now, but over his career, he represented six players who are now in the Baseball Hall of Fame, including Cal Ripken Jr., Brooks Robinson, and Kirby Puckett. Mr. Shapiro has written four books on the art of negotiating with a philosophy of win-win and what he calls the power of nice. His first book, published in 1998, was titled The Power of Nice, How to Negotiate So Everyone Wins, Especially You. He was on the Florida Gulf Coast University campus last week to give a talk titled Nice, A Soft Approach to Tough Conversations, that offered advice on how to approach difficult conversations, especially during the highly charged and polarized times that we find ourselves in. He stopped by the studio to chat while he was on campus. Let's hear that now. Welcome to the show, Mr. Shapiro. It's great to have you in studio.
Mike, it's great to be with you.
So your talk that you're giving today on campus is titled Nice, A Soft Approach to a Tough Conversations. The title of your first book in 98 was The Power of Nice, How to Negotiate So Everyone Wins. What I'm wondering is when you were in college and at Harvard Law School and getting whatever kind of training you got to be a negotiator, where did nice fit into the equation back then?
Well, I value relationships. I understand the importance of relationships. So that when I moved from that kind of a setting into the real world and I started to negotiate and started to deal with people, I realized that we might at times be on opposite sides of the table. But I also realized that when we left the room, we would have to deal with each other. And so the concept of nice was, look, it's power of nice, so I'm not saying don't empower yourself with a system that I lay out in the book. But what I am saying is if you can walk away giving them some of what they want and you get what you want and everybody feels good about the discussion, and even if you can't give them what they want, you're not tearing each other apart. That relationship can pay off later on. If you're doing a contract, in implementing the contract. If you're just in the world together, when you next cross paths and have to deal with each other. And that's the essence of why I preach the power of nice.
Is that something, though, that you had to develop on your own rather than being taught? I mean, is that it seems to me that if I were to guess what you were being taught in the times you were in school, nice was probably not part of the vocabulary.
Well, it wasn't, but I was raised by a father who was an immigrant who was pulled out of school at a young age and trained himself by selling newspapers and reading them and selling encyclopedias and reading them, but also wanting to build his own business. And he loved people. He loved relationships. Lesson number one, if I can digress for just a
moment. Absolutely.
He said, Ron, I want you to remember this. The man working in the maintenance department in the basement of the building is as important as the person in the chair seat at the top of the building. Treat everyone with respect. So I was raised in an atmosphere where caring about people and respecting people was important. And I think that carried over. When I got into the sports world by mistake and I started to negotiate high-profile contracts, I didn't have to have press conferences to show everyone how strong I was and how I could dominate the other side. I just wanted to do deals. And I wanted people to be happy. I wanted a player to play well, and I wanted a team to win and a community to love the player. And that all, I think, grew from within the familial setting that I grew up in.
If you didn't grow up in a familial setting like that, if that wasn't part of your bones and your ethos, is that something that you can learn, or is that a human nature thing that's hard to overcome?
I'm here at the university this week to speak about a civil approach to difficult conversations. And really, when you think about it, what I'm trying to do is communicate to students in this case, and some faculty, to communicate the ideas about the importance of connection. And connection comes from relationships. That comes from doing things the right way. And I think you can teach it, because what I'm doing is giving people tools how to prepare, how to ask questions, how to listen effectively, that they can carry into the world and add to their toolbox for dealing with other people, being nice.
So the foundations of what you would use to negotiate a contract for Cal Ripken Jr. are the same ones that people can apply when having difficult conversations, because, as you know, we are in polarized times where there's lots of interpersonal tension to dispel.
One of the things I will be talking about, or I am talking about here, is those polarized times and friendships and people being on the opposite sides of the political divide, and how not to lose those friendships just because you don't both believe the same thing. They're extremes, and you know those you can't control. But there are people on the opposite side. If they gave each other a little time, if they validated the other person by asking questions and learning why they feel that way and understanding it, there are things that can be learned to help bridge the gap in these divided times. In my talk, I talk about the only peace treaty that's ever worked in the Middle East. It was the Camp David Accords of 1979. Jimmy Carter was not a guy who pounded his chest and told people what to do. He was just a quiet questioner and listener. And the only reason he could bring two arch enemies together, Israel and Egypt, was by going in the room and asking the leaders of those nations why they didn't want to do what the other party wanted them to do. And slowly but surely gathering information, letting them vent, and letting them feel invested in the process. And ultimately, that led to the Camp David Accords of 1979. I went to the dinner at the White House. It was an amazing night. Something was achieved by human choice that nobody felt could be achieved. That's the power of nice again.
It seems to me that, especially in interpersonal dynamics, that having your emotional state overwhelm you, so where you're just reacting instead of responding, where does that fit in?
Reaction has to come out of it. I mean, this whole game of, oh, he said that and I'm going to get him, is what we want to put aside. What we want to put on the table is learning how to ask questions. I teach people a little system I call what. You know, instead of saying, give me what I want, you say to them, listen, I hear what you're saying, but why is that important to you? What else is important to you? What's most important? Oh, you say no. What do you mean by that? And then H, hypothesize. You say you don't have it in the budget? Well, have you ever had it in the budget where you could do it? Or if you had it in the budget, would you support this project? They say yes, you can build something. They say no, then ask another question. What do you mean by that? I could go on with A and T, but what I'm trying to say is there is a methodology to cutting down on reaction and increasing the action of engaging them and making them feel that they're part of the process.
One of my close friends has spent his career at high levels in different corporate settings, and he's taught me years ago the power of help me understand.
Well, that
just that phrase, just if it's a tense moment, help me understand how, and do it honestly, and that seems to have some sort of dispelling power.
Don't ask questions which lead to yeah, no. Ask questions which let them help you understand. That's what's important to you. Same thing.
Hmm. So you graduate from Harvard Law School in 67.
Yep.
You found your first law firm in 72. You start the sports agency thing in 76. Just a minute ago, you said that that happened by accident. I thought maybe you were just a baseball fan who thought, I've got a law degree and I live in Baltimore and maybe I could make a few bucks getting to be around baseball.
Let me show you how accidental life is, okay? I graduate law school and I want to desegregate housing in my community of Baltimore.
Because that was an interesting time to graduate law school.
I'm a civil rights lawyer, but I'm making no money for my law firm. So they say to me, hey, if you want to do this stuff, you can do it. But here, take these securities law, that's investment law books, and help us build some stuff. And you can do that too. So I do it. And the investment law stuff and the civil rights law come together in how I became a sports agent. Because some years later, I became securities commissioner of Maryland in 1972.
What does that mean in one sentence?
It means
I
regulate all the investments in the state. I go after the fraud guys who scam people in investments. And what it led to was that in 1975, when the legend of the Baltimore Orioles, and I talk about him on campus too, Brooks Robinson, Hall of Famer, great human being, when he was about to go bankrupt, the Baltimore Orioles called me and said, help him work out of this mess. And I help him work out of this mess. And later on, I say to the owner of the Orioles, why did you call me? I was a kid. You got all kinds of, you know. They said, we read about your work as a securities commissioner and busting frauds, and you helped my nephew during the Vietnam War when he was going to leave the country and escape the draft. You talked him into staying and finding an alternative way to serve. And because of that, I called you. That's accident. Now I'm a sports agent to the greatest player, greatest third baseman in the history of the game, and the rest is history in terms of my becoming an accidental agent.
How many people who made it into the Hall of Fame did you represent?
I represented six, and as of a year ago, that's more than anyone else, but soon a fellow named Scott Boras will represent the lion's share.
In reading up on you, I found several people describe you as a super agent. What's the difference between a super agent and an agent?
That's an exaggeration, but it makes for good headlines. You know, when you represent the kind of people I represented, the Cal Ripkins, the Joe Mauers, the Kirby Pucketts, the Eddie Murrays, the Jim Palmers, the array of people I represented, good people. I loved my players, because they believed in the old saying, you make a living by what you get, you make a life by what you give, and they gave back to their communities. So people in the communities like me, so they gave me the word super, but it doesn't mean that I'm any better than anyone else. It means I stay there and I don't tear apart the relationship with the team, and they get good deals.
Were you a baseball fan by nature already?
Well, I was a baseball fan because baseball was my father's love. You know, and he loved it because baseball broke all kinds of barriers back in the 50s and the 40s and the 50s. But yeah, I was like a kid in a candy store when I was asked to represent Brooks.
That was mostly what I was getting at. It seemed like it must have been really cool.
But it became the greatest bully pulpit in the world for me to go out and companies to say to me, well, look, you do those sports contracts, teach our people how to negotiate. And that led to my founding a negotiations institute in the 90s. And then I found the most satisfying aspect of my life, and that was teaching others the power of nice, and the other principles, the other books that I've written, and going around the world and making people more effective in making deals and building relationships. And that Negotiations Institute was the ultimate empowerment of my life because I found satisfaction in that like nothing else I'd done.
I'd like to take a moment to reintroduce my guest. Ron Shapiro is a prominent American attorney, sports agent, and expert negotiator known for his win-win philosophy. Mr. Shapiro is often referred to as one of the most respected agents in professional sports. I might dispute that, he says, because he's not a super agent. He was on the Florida Gulf Coast University campus last Thursday to give a talk as part of the university's Provost Seminar Series. He'll also be talking with the Naples Discussion Group while he's here in town. If you'd like to engage with the show about this or any of our conversations, use our social media. We are WGCU Public Media on Facebook and Instagram. As somebody who has such rich experience in negotiating and how humans interact with each other, and this may sound like a strange question, I've interviewed a lot of musicians, and they hear music differently. They hear things that us normal people don't hear. Do you see things differently? Do you see human interaction? Do you see, oh, that could be different? You know what I mean? Does it create a different perspective for you when you watch people having disagreements or arguments?
Well, because of my fondness for people and because of my desire for connection, I just look at them as a challenge to bring them to that connection point. I don't know that I see it differently than other people see it, but you talk about musicians. One of the great learning stories I tell about is settling a Baltimore Symphony Orchestra strike back in the 80s. And it took every bit of process that I know to do that. But I learned that musicians are different people. They look at music differently. They look at negotiations differently. And I had to bring them together with the management of that orchestra in order to make things happen. Everybody looks at things from their own perspective. And part of the process of being a good negotiator is finding out what the perspective is all about by asking questions, before you start proposing what the deal should be.
As we referred to earlier, we are in polarized times. Are we in more polarized times now than we would have been when you were in college, or not?
It was pretty polarized. I mean, you know, we had a Vietnam War that split the country. We had Vietnam veterans coming home to the vituperation and anger of the public and being treated terribly. So that was a tough time. But I think a decade prior to that, the time of Joe McCarthy and the Army McCarthy hearings and the divisions in the nation then, we've had some pretty divided times. I can go all the way back to Andrew Jackson and post-Civil War period. But what exacerbates these polarized times is social media. And the ability of people to communicate things that aren't fact as if they are fact. And that contributes to the division in a way that it didn't exist in those prior times. And so I'm still giving thought to how we find our way out of it. But one of the things that attracted me to coming to Florida Gulf Coast University was the opportunity to talk to students and faculty about ways that we might do that, how we might hold those difficult conversations in a more civil fashion so that we might reconstruct rather than destruct the society of ours.
I hope you don't mind me asking this, mm-hmm. but I just think you'll have an interesting perspective. What are your thoughts on the increasing or the rapid rise of sports betting and prediction markets?
Not happy about it.
Seems like it's foiling a lot of stuff.
Not happy about it because I think it's affecting the game. Well, we know it's affecting the game. There are people who have been indicted. There are people who are being investigated. Betting is, you know, what do I think of people drinking, getting drunk? I don't like them getting drunk, okay? But we've set it up so that drinking is accessible. And getting drunk is a manifestation of the negatives of that. And there's no control, really, until people kill people by drunk driving, let's say. Well, betting, we're legitimizing it in a way where you can get it off the shelf, and there's so many variations of it. And, you know, it's not just who's wins the game. It's what the next pitch is. It's whether he's going to scratch his ear or scratch his nose. It's all kinds of things. And I think it's wreaking havoc with the game and its integrity. And yet it's such a gigantic economic piece. And this is what drives us in this crazy society of the game that I don't know it's going to be relinquished. But I will speak out against it when I can.
It just seems like it would be such a temptation for a sports figure who could be bet on for whether they scratch their nose to say, hey, I'm going to scratch my nose. You know what I mean? It just seems like there's just too much temptation.
Let's go back to the beginning when it wasn't even legal. I mean, Pete Rose had the greatest career in the history of baseball. He bet. He was pulled in. Others have done it. It's something that needs much more control, but it's so divided in terms of who does what to control it that I'm fearful, at least for the short term.
You're retired as an attorney, right?
I'm semi-retired as an attorney. I don't charge for services. I help people with problems. I'm a help desk, and I love helping people, but I have to be careful. You know, 83, coming to do a speaking tour like I'm doing down here. I'm speaking to two different groups. It's work, but it's also stimulation, and it's life. So the answer is I'm a retired attorney who's still doing something.
Retired sports agent?
I am totally retired as a sports agent. I have a son who is the CEO of the team that almost won the World Series last year.
I picked up on that.
The Toronto Blue Jays. And so I, you know, look at his world now and cherish and appreciate what he's doing in the leadership of the sport of baseball. I work with the owner of the Baltimore Ravens as a special advisor. So I'm involved in sports, but no, I no longer am a sports agent.
Are you retired as an author? Got any more books in you?
I write poetry.
Really?
Yeah, I write poetry because I write them to someone I love, and I write them about friends who I care about, and I enjoy that. And the speech I wrote to deliver at Florida Gulf Coast, I craft every word. I love crafting words because words impact on people. Sometimes that means I'm not quite as spontaneous when I give a speech, but I think it has more impact. And so I'm still writing. Do I have another book in me? I think for trade books. I've written law books too, but 4 trade books is enough, and I've gotten, you know, down what I wanted to get down, so I think I've hit the limit there.
Any chance of publishing any poetry?
Probably not, but I do love it. I do love to express myself. I'm on my 3rd volume of a book called, 3rd year it is, Poem a Day. And the talk I'm giving at Florida Gulf Coast has a poem to conclude it. The poem is about the subject, Difficult Conversations. It's called Walking in a Minefield by a Scottish author named Lane Creighton Smith. But the point I want to make is I read that poem on the day I crafted what I thought was the last sentence of my talk, and I made that the conclusion of it because I love poetry.
Any chance we can get you to read that poem that you're going to end the speech with before we end the show?
Well, I don't memorize poems, but yeah, I can give you sort of the end of the speech, which sort of summarizes the poem and my feelings and how it ties into difficult conversations. I tell the group that I want to close with a thought from this Scottish poet, Lane Creighton Smith, and it's called Walking in a Minefield. He reminds us in that poem that the world can feel like a minefield. One wrong word and the room explodes. One careless gesture and someone we care about is hurt. But he also says that the world is a garden, that roses have thorns, but they are still roses. And as I told the group in conclusion at my talk, that's the challenge of difficult conversations. Not to stop walking, not to armor up, but to walk lightly and walk hopefully. If we can do that, ask a little more, declare a little less, we don't just avoid the minds, we give the conversation a chance to grow. And that's it.
In preparing for this, Mr. Shapiro, I never dreamed we'd be talking about poetry, but that's why I love having conversations.
And isn't poetry wonderful?
It is. Ron Shapiro is an attorney, sports agent, and expert negotiator these days. He runs Shapiro Advisors, LLC, counseling organizations and individuals on negotiations and best business practices. Thank you so much for your time, Mr. Shapiro.
It was my pleasure, Mike.
This conversation was recorded on Thursday, February 26th, when Mr. Shapiro was on the Florida Gulf Coast University campus to give a talk for the Provost's seminar series. It was titled NICE, A Soft Approach to Tough Conversations. He also talked with the Naples Discussion Group while he was in Southwest Florida. Our show today was produced by yours truly. For now, thank you for listening. I'm Mike Canary. This is WGCU-FM, Fort Myers 90.1, WMKO Marco Island 91.7 FM. We are NPR for Southwest Florida.